The following show is produced and distributed by the Gab Radio Network.
You've heard AM, you've heard FM. Now, tune in to DM Radio, the world's longest-running show about data. Each week, host Eric Cavanaugh interviews the brightest minds in the world of information management. Want to be on a show? Send an email to info@dmradio.biz. Now, here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
Oh, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again. It is time for DM Radio. My name is Eric Cavanaugh. I will be your humble, if excitable, host for the show that is designed to peel away the marketing veneer, get down to brass tacks, and figure out what is going on in the world of data. It's everywhere these days, folks. We're in the information economy, or as my buddy Wayne Eckerson would call it, the insights economy, because most businesses are being run by insights these days. The smart ones are, the successful ones are, and if you're focused on that, you're going to be successful too. I have to say, data is the glue, it's the lifeblood, it's the oil, they say these days, and you have to manage it very carefully. Well, the topic for today is a pretty big one, folks. We're talking about this overarching architecture above us called the cloud, cloud computing. First of all, a quick nod to our partner, Dataversity. Hop online to dataversity.net to find out all the latest. We just did a big show yesterday, all day long, six webcasts all about data governance. That's a pretty serious issue these days. If you're in the business of working with data in any way, shape, or form, you better be focused on governance too. But Enterprise Data World is coming up soon in San Diego, so hop online and check out that. Hopefully, we'll see you down there in San Diego for that. And let's dive right in, folks, the cloud. So the title of today's show is, Could Cloud Finally Overtake On-Prem? Maybe. Of course, by on-prem, we mean on-premises. So that's standard data centers, the way it's been done for many, many years now. Companies have their own data centers that they use to crank out whatever it is that they're doing. And you know, I remember learning from my partner, Dr. Robin Vlore, a number of years ago, one of the really critical components about data center financing and just the financials around running a data center, he said one of the challenges is that if you wind up needing another machine, sometimes it's not just another machine you need, but another whole data center. Because back in the day, once that data center is filled, you can't fit anything else in there. And so building another data center is actually really, really expensive. But one of my favorite jokes that I've learned just last year was that these days, friends don't let friends build data centers anymore. You just don't do that. You rent that stuff these days. You rent it from Amazon or from Google or from Rackspace. And of course, now all the major vendors are into the cloud space. Oracle has its cloud. IBM has Bluemix. Of course, Amazon Web Services. You've got the SAP cloud platform. Those guys have come to the table with a lot of energy and force. And folks, we have an all-star cast today that's going to be telling us all about that stuff. So I'll just say a couple quick words here. In the media, we're always trying to look forward, I think maybe because we're maybe a bit bored with the present or we want to prognosticate. But I can tell you that I've been a bit surprised at how long it took for the enterprise, for really big business, to fully embrace the cloud. And you think about stuff like Mark Benioff with Salesforce.com, that was like 20-odd years ago that those guys started out. It's kind of a long time ago now. And that's, of course, a juggernaut. I mean, anyone who's ever gone to Dreamforce, that thing takes over downtown San Francisco. It's just amazing how big it's become. All these events are getting just huge. Amazon, of course, just had their reInvent conference recently. And you can kind of see the handwriting all over the wall and the clouds and the earth and the mountains and everywhere, that a whole new array of vendors are stepping up to the plate these days. Google is getting serious about the enterprise. It's taken a really long time for these guys to get in there and to penetrate the space that companies like, frankly, SAP and IBM and Oracle have dominated for years and years. Even Microsoft, of course, with Azure is getting serious about cloud. And frankly, I think it has been what has kind of brought them back from the edge. You're looking at a company that was the powerhouse for desktop computing, and they kind of fell apart there for a while. I mean, they still were making a lot of money, but they had lost their advantage, and now they're getting it back by focusing on cloud. So we have several wonderful guests for you today. We're going to hear from David Linthicum, now of Deloitte these days, a good buddy of mine, David Friend from Wasabi, plus Chris Carter from Aproio, and Manoj Nair from Hypergrid. You should look all these companies up online. Fascinating organizations. And I'll start with you, David Linthicum. I've known about you for years, but I did not realize that you're the $2 billion million man. That's a pretty impressive statistic, David. Congratulations on that one. So tell us a bit about what you're seeing out there with your clients. And of course, you've got a lot of them, and you got a lot of people working at Deloitte. Does the enterprise finally have the cloud religion?
Yeah, they sure do, and I think that's really kind of the short answer. And ultimately, this is about the ability to kind of add value to what their business does. And so if you talk to the enterprises out there, the conversation 5 years ago, 3 years ago, was about cost efficiencies. In other words, the CapEx versus OpEx thing. I can, you know, move my stuff into a public cloud provider, and therefore I can get out of the data center business. I don't have to buy hardware and software. I don't have to maintain it. So that's a good thing. And I think they've done that, and they've understood that there's some value there. But right now the light's coming on in terms of the enterprises and as to what the real value of cloud computing is. The ability to, in essence, build an IT infrastructure that's able to disrupt whatever business that they're in. And right now the corporations out there are looking at a lot of smaller competitors that are basically changing the game in the particular industry. Of course, Uber and Netflix and all the ones that pop up to mind, Airbnb, are the ones that everybody throws up. But the thing is, manufacturing is changing to the use of robotics, the ability to do logistics planning, ship things from A to B, the ability to get things that you need in a single day. Amazon's changing the world there. All these things are really occurring, and they're looking at IT as the ability to kind of automate and make these things possible for their business. And of course, if they continue to build data centers, continue to buy hardware and software every time they want to put up an application, that's ultimately going to make them run into one wall after another wall. It's going to be too slow, too cumbersome, too complex to get them done. So leveraging cloud is really turning into an enterprise strategic thing now. So the conversation's not just around OpEx versus CapEx, but the ability to, in essence, make things more agile, compress time to market, and change the nature of the business. And that's exciting.
Yeah, it really is exciting. And for those who don't know CapEx and OpEx, he's talking about capital expenditures, big chunks in the budget versus operating expenditures, little small departmental budgets. And yeah, that's one of the things that has really changed. And I think you're right that it is some smaller companies out there that are really innovating and doing fascinating things. And then, of course, the bigger companies pay attention. Sometimes the smaller companies get acquired a lot of times, quite frankly. I think we're in another era of consolidation right now. But it's just amazing to see the speed of innovation these days. When you talk about what some of these companies have done, and I always point to, like you suggest, the Ubers, for example, and the Amazons, these guys went out and they built bulletproof, scalable infrastructure. But the other thing they did that I think is really critical and is, frankly, a critical success factor is they really focused on decomposing key business processes and then figuring out how to re-architect those in a parallel environment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And see, ultimately, they are becoming better at building things quicker. And I think that's kind of the core advantage that they're finding in the cloud, as well as some of the newer technologies, such as the development and operations technologies that are around and agile methodologies and things like that. So the idea is now to look at the impediments, and digital's about this as well, look at the impediments as to what it's going to take to get things in place, processes change down to the detailed level, and be able to remove those impediments and automate as much as you can. So the last mile automation is really occurring right now, the ability to kind of automate things that traditionally we thought couldn't be automated or were too expensive to automate. And cloud computing is really kind of setting the trend in that space because it's making it possible because we don't have to go out there and make the capital expenditures, you know, that we need to make to make this possible. So going forward, this is incredibly exciting because in 10 years, we're going to have a very different business environment, which is going to be driven by the changes in the way in which we consume IT. Cloud computing is not only just enabling technology, it's transformative technology, the ability to kind of take businesses to levels where they couldn't have been before. And in terms of the Global 2000, you know, they're getting the religion to get to your current point, but also the startups and the smaller businesses out there are able to punch way above their weight. And so they're able to look like and act like and perform like big companies, which is unprecedented. So, again, it's exciting.
Yeah, and I tell you what, that's a really good segue to bring in our second guest here. And David Linthicum, stick around to help us interview these other guests and for the roundtable, because a good buddy of mine, David Friend from Wasabi, is one of those small companies that just launched last year, about mid-year last year, doing cloud storage. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because I run in circles of analysts and I'm always talking to these really, really smart people. But one thing I've noticed about really smart people is they can sometimes kind of outsmart themselves. And one of the things that I heard from one of the smartest people I know is, oh, there's no there in cloud storage because Red Hat has this Ceph storage, object storage that is basically free. If you just do it right, it's more or less free if you use the open source stuff. But the problem is you have to have people who know how to hack all that code, and that's a fairly rare skill set. And besides which, there's something to be said for sales and marketing and innovation and how you do stuff. And I see a tremendous market out there for cloud storage. And that'll be my segue to bring in David Friend from Wasabi. David, welcome to DM Radio, and tell us a bit about the opportunity that you guys saw. And if you would, tell us about how you do it and how you don't even use Linux or these different operating systems. You built your own, right?
Yeah. So, Eric, hi. Nice to talk to you again. We're cloud storage experts. It's all we do. We founded a backup company called Carbonite that probably many of your listeners know and perhaps use. The statistics on the amount of data that's being accumulated, you know, not just the traditional kinds of data that you get from an enterprise, but things like IoT, you know, everything's producing data nowadays. Your watch produces data, your car produces data, you fly on an airplane, the jet engines are producing data, even my refrigerator produces data. And it all has to go somewhere. And all of these wonderful analytical programs that we're seeing and all of the insights that businesses are getting in terms of being able to predict what's going to happen in the future. I mean, for instance, in the case of the jet engines, GE uses the data from the engines to predict when maintenance is going to be needed. All of that requires that the data be stored somewhere where it can be gotten at really quickly and very inexpensively. And so, excuse me, we saw an opportunity to use our technology to create what we think of as a commodity cloud storage product. And Wasabi is, if you know what Amazon S3 is, you pretty much know what Wasabi is, but we're one-fifth the price and six times the speed. And, you know, that's a fairly easy proposition to sell. And even though you may say Ceph is free, you still got to buy the hardware. Right. And that's going to cost you significantly more than the 0.39 cents per gigabyte per month that Wasabi charges.
Right. Well,
so you asked about how we do it because a lot of people are, well, how do they do that? And, you know, the truth of the matter is that our engineers know how to sort of literally grab hold of the heads on the disk drives and put the bits on disk in a way that's optimized for the kind of storage that we do. And very few people know how to do that. It's a very arcane end of software. And I would imagine that products like Amazon S3 are basically hand that task off to Linux, and in some cases, Windows, for example. The only people who really know how to do this very low-level stuff are the guys in the operating system teams at Microsoft or Red Hat or whatever. And so, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. It's taken us, you know, more than a decade to figure out how to do all of these things and do them well. But the result is we think storage is going to be like electricity or bandwidth. It's just going to be a commodity. Why would you need all of these tiers and everything? I see these, you know, you got Glacier, Nearline, Coldline, reduced redundancy, infrequent access, S3. If you've got one commodity product that's faster than the fastest and cheaper than the cheapest, you don't need those sort of things any more than you need three plugs in the wall for, you know, good quality electricity, crummy electricity, and really crappy but cheap electricity.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking to myself, I will bet that in a lot of these environments where you have tiered storage for hot storage and cold storage, well, sometimes obviously you're just storing it in cache, right? And you guys do some of that too. But I think you've got basically a management layer that sits on top of the storage, which is responsible for handling that, which is basically just some form of cache, right?
Yeah. You don't really need all of that. It adds a whole layer of complexity, and the truth of the matter is we're moving from an era when fast storage was expensive and slow storage was cheap to an era where it's all cheap.
Right.
You know, the fastest is going to be, well, except for very edge cases, I think 95% of all storage will be in one tier, and all of these slow things like tape, which are actually more expensive than hot storage, kind that we produce anyway, that stuff eventually goes away, and as will a lot of on-prem stuff, because if you look at the cost of storing a petabyte of data in Wasabi, it's less than the annual maintenance cost for a petabyte worth of storage from, say, EMC or any of the other NetApp, any of the other on-prem storage vendors. So I think a lot of that goes away eventually.
Well, and you've also promoted a concept, and David Linthicum, whom I'd like to bring you back in here to get your comment on this. I've been talking with David for a while now about a standard for storage, right? If you think about standards, my partner Robin Bloor used to muse that there are basically two kinds of standards. There are ones where everybody sort of agrees that this is the best way to do things, and then there are ones that are imposed on the world by some overpowering force, such as a software provider that dominates a particular market. But I have to wonder to myself, are we going to see a standard for storage? Because right now, of course, Google and Microsoft and Amazon have their proprietary mechanisms, and David, I think, was pretty clever to mimic the Amazon one. But do you see in the future where we'll get more of a standard around cloud storage, such that you can rip and replace and pull it from one place, put it to another fairly easily?
I think moving in that direction.
Yeah, go ahead, David Linthicum. Sorry.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
sorry
ahead,
about
David.
That. Yeah. I think ultimately it's really going to be a de facto kind of way things are going to go, and you're going to have some organizations, and certainly with good intentions for, you know, bringing up ways in which we can standardize the storage systems. But the problem with that is that storage has a tendency to be very much use case driven, and so the formats you use and the optimization and those sorts of things really depends on the pattern of the applications that are accessing the systems. It's very much a different play to do an online transaction processing system versus a, you know, data warehouse, you know, analytics system, you know, versus a access sometimes versus backup and recovery, and all those things are going to be very different. So I think that we're going to start moving down to a couple of three different kinds of standards out there that are going to be around those patterns of use. And then people are going to use those because it's going to provide some, at least from data portability, storage portability between the cloud providers that are out there. Because right now, if you move between providers, you have to think about this stuff. You have to think about the format in which things are stored on one system versus how they need to be translated and transposed to exist on another system. And it's a huge risk in the environment. And the reality is that cloud providers want everybody to be on the cloud. And if it means that they have to offer portability to other clouds to attract enterprises into the cloud, they're more than willing to do that. Standards work in their favor for that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And David Friend, real quick, you wanted to comment on that too?
Yeah, well, we know that, you know, customers hate vendor lock-in, and in an ideal world, somebody should be able to take all their data, pack up, and move from Amazon to Google, or from Google to Microsoft, or from any of those to Wasabi, without having to rewrite their applications. And that is not the case today, for the most part. But I think there's a move towards the Amazon S3 API as being kind of a de facto standard. And in fact, I read recently that Google has decided to throw their hat in that ring as well, which will really make that almost a given.
Yeah, right. Well, standards are nice because you don't want your end users to be floundering out there and like trying to sort through some challenge of moving from one place to another. And we'll talk to our next couple of guests after the break here in just about 40 seconds. We'll go to break. But I have to say, I think that portability is key. You know, one of the nice benefits of the whole movement these days around open source is that it really has changed the dynamic. It's changed the DNA for how people think about this stuff. And I think the rest of the world, of the software world, really did get the religion that they need to avoid vendor lock-in. You need to earn your keep basically by keeping your clients happy. You need to earn your money month after month, year after year. That's important stuff. So folks, we're going to be right back after a couple of minutes. You are listening to DM Radio.
I saluted Walmart last week, but it may have been premature. There were good numbers released recently, but they don't tell the whole story. Oh well, we'll discuss next on Dan's Life.
For many businesses, hiring is tough. You want access to highly qualified candidates fast, and you don't want to sign a long-term contract or pay upfront fees. That's why you need Indeed.com, delivering six times more hires than any other job site, according to independent research. Indeed is offering new users a $50 credit to give their first job post premium visibility as a sponsored job. Redeem this offer at Indeed.com/credit. That's Indeed.com/credit. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So I did tip my cap to Walmart for raising wages by $2 an hour. Then I read they're closing a ton of Sam's Club locations, not necessarily the worst thing, but other job cuts should follow at regular locations as the company moves to more self-checkout machines instead of human associates. So much for bonuses and high wages. At least jobless claims are down in America to the lowest number since 73, and unemployment on the whole since 2000. But what about wages? Still not in line with the cost of living, and we, as a people, aren't saving. There's good news in manufacturing, for now, but industry analysts predict that many of the job gains we've seen will be done away with in the coming years as machines and artificial intelligence systems are perfected. Man, now I'm struggling to find that silver lining that points to all things being perfectly grand. But it's never perfect. I think things are pretty much like they always are, somewhere in the middle, imperfect, but not cataclysmic. We're not in the Great Depression or anything, after all. And let's be honest, most people are doing okay. And by okay, I mean fed, clothed, and having shelter. And that's better than it has been in the past in this country and around the world.
Find out more about Dan's life on Facebook at French and Friends. That's at French and Friends.
So, be positive, blue skies ahead for us, for you and me, here in Dan's life.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, back here on DM Radio, talking all about the cloud. It's everywhere these days, like I said at the top of the hour. I thought cloud would be much more prominent in the enterprise 5 and 10 years ago. It's taken a long time, but it's there now, folks. It is a reality. It's all over the place. It's changing business. And one of the big companies that is getting very serious about cloud is, of course, the German software giant SAP. I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years working with those guys. And I really have to take my hat off to Mr. Hasso Plattner, of course, a co-founder of SAP way back in the day, because about 12 years ago, I think it was, he threw down the gauntlet and said, we're going entirely in memory. So an in-memory architecture, which let's face it, 12 years ago, that was a very, very expensive proposition, certainly for a large organization with a lot of data. To put everything in memory back then was outrageously expensive, but he must have seen the tea leaves. He must have known what was coming, because slowly but surely we watched the price of RAM, of flash, of solid state memory, solid state disks going down, 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 and the price of disks, well, still it's cheaper, but you have to think that they're going to cross paths before too long. And memory is, you know, it's basically 1,000 to 10,000 times faster than spinning disk, depending upon what you're doing. So I think Hasso really, he did kind of what Amazon Web Services did, in that he got a huge head start on a big idea, which was to go in memory. And our next guest, Christopher Carter, is the CEO of a company called Aproio that has quite cleverly followed in that those footsteps and is now providing cloud services for SAP. Chris Carter, welcome to DM Radio.
Hey, Eric. Glad to be here.
Hey, sure thing. So tell us, what are your thoughts around this in-memory movement in the cloud? I mean, I think just from your perspective, you guys really had to sharpen your pencils and do some pretty serious architectural work to support that stuff. Can you kind of explain why that's such a big deal and why you saw the opportunity?
Yeah, there was a huge opportunity. It was interesting. Back in 1999 and 2000, I was very fortunate to build the first SAP virtualized cloud, or we called it a virtual encapsulation back then. We didn't call it a cloud. And I ended up selling that company and then retiring for a little bit. And I ended up taking some time and actually going to visit with Hasso out in Waldorf. And then I went to SAP Labs in Palo Alto and started to see what this new in-memory and this HANA solution set was. And I really grasped immediately how this was going to change just business in general, but then also how data in general, because it allowed me to take so much data in memory and be able to go through it in almost an instantaneous fashion. And if you remember about 10 years ago when he announced this, and I decided to come back out of retirement, was the fact that being able to do everything fast, speed was everything back then. And so that's why you started to see all these companies with VMware-based servers and just virtualizing everything and anything they could to try and get more speed. Well, by putting that into the memory piece now you really accelerated that process. And I can still remember sitting with Hasso at the time and Vishal Fika, who was actually the chief technology officer before he left the organization. We sat in a group of about 20 of us, and one of the points that was made by Hasso was the fact that when he started the process of looking into in-memory, he knew it was going to work simply from the fact that every customer he talked to for SAP wanted things done faster. They didn't want anything slower. They wanted it faster. And the only way to get that process done faster was either to add more RAM, add more tube, or to go into that memory chip itself. And so when he started working with it with the team at Stanford, because he's got a class of folks there at the Hasso Institute and others like myself, that we were doing it for free of charge to him, we knew that we could see the writing on the wall. Every company wants speed, they want their data, and they want it now. It's an instantaneous gratification, as they like to call it.
Yeah, and there are a couple of really key points there, too, one of which is that you can collapse business processes when you can crunch that many numbers that quickly, right? So you don't have to wait for something to process, and that requires a bit of a redesigning effort around the application, around the process. And, of course, that's what SAP has been focused on the last 10 years, is redesigning those applications to live in this more real-time world. And you just think about stuff like forecasting and planning, right? It used to be that you have to set aside a week or 2 weeks or something to do your forecasting. Well, now you can run Monte Carlo assessments and do all kinds of different things that you just could not have done before, which makes the business more agile, right?
Absolutely correct. The agility that it gave organizations running SAP software was just incredible, because what it allowed us to do is we could go into those customers, and we're an SAP partner, so we would literally walk in the door, say, give me your data. I guarantee you I can run it so much faster. We were seeing 20x, 25x times faster. So think about the end of month or end of year closings of books, when companies would literally say, I have to take 1 month or 2 months to do it. Well, now, because of the regulations that are out there on some of these organizations, they literally would have to have this done in a much faster timeline. We had a company that literally had petabytes of data that we literally were able to get done in a day. That literally took them 2 months to be able to go through that data. And that's the speed and also the accuracy that it gave with the automation of these activities and the speed of these activities with HANA. So it's a really big win-win for everybody out there. And that's the reason why Bill McDermott, the CEO of SAP, is sitting next to the President of the United States in Davos, Switzerland this week, because every one of their customers is basically at that table, and they're helping them grow their businesses with HANA.
Yeah, and you know, there's another really critical point here to consider, which is just the whole philosophy around how to manage data, because in the past, thanks to the fact that you had to separate out these processes, well, you wind up duplicating a lot of data. You create data warehouses, for example, where you would pull data from all these, from your ERP, from your CRM, all these different systems, marshal it into a separate area, and then do your analytics. And then that's an offline process now. And it's a disconnected process is really the key. That's the word I'm looking for. And that slows down the business where now, and this is part of the architecture in HANA, as I understand it, it was designed to do both analytical processing and transactional processing. So now you don't have to separate those worlds out. You don't have to create these silos of data, because let's face it, that creates all kinds of problems. It was something we had to do back in the day because the processing speed just wasn't there. But you don't have to do that anymore. You know, like there are whole teams of people that are simply no longer needed, at least to focus on that kind of challenge anymore, right? That's the thing, is that you really have to wrap your head around the magnitude of change, right?
Oh, the change is phenomenal, because now you can take streams of data from multiple third-party systems that you have throughout your organization, no matter if it's your finance team over here in your warehouse or whoever, and you want to combine data together, you just do an API connection into your SAP environment and allow that S4 environment to run in whatever segment you want. Run a report on these different areas, and you're picking 5, 10, 20 different streams of data all at the same time. And it literally will churn and burn through that because of it's going into the memory chip. Now, when you're done with it, you can put it back into your data storage and it can sit there for the end of the year. Now, there's companies that I deal with that have so many legacy environments that literally they turn it on once a year to be able to grab that legacy data, be able to run a report with it, and it stays there. It does not go into a third party or secondary staging area then to be used. It's a direct connection. And you're right, as far as the staff members, now these large groups of data analysts can go off and they can do projects. They can go off and run new different solution sets that the business needs, not just the IT team, but what the business needs. And that's changing the game for these businesses, because now they're taking these highly skilled individuals and they're letting them grow and think and come up with new ideas to help the business side of it. And it's a really awesome game changer.
Yeah, that's just amazing stuff. And we'll dig more into this in the roundtable, and we'll bring back David Linthicum for that. But in the meantime, let's bring in our final guest, Manoj Nair of Hypergrid, another company doing some really, really interesting things, creating a sort of service layer for managing multi-cloud environments. So Manoj, welcome to DM Radio.
Thanks, Eric. Glad to be here, and thanks for the invite.
Sure. So could you explain a little bit of how you guys have done this? Because I find this absolutely fascinating, that you can have a management layer for dealing with data and functionality from multiple cloud environments. What's going on? Is the architecture such that you've got a sort of data layer which is pulling from various sources and maybe even using some old but tried and true technologies like change data capture, for example, which we've had for 40 plus years or so, and then a functionality layer too? Walk us through how you're actually able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. If we take a step back, we here at Hypergrid are big believers that the cloud really is a model, not a destination. And Chris, and you were just talking about one example of an application transformation required, because all of a sudden now you can have near instant recall for application data. To take advantage of that, you need to move your application to this model. So that's really the fundamentals that we have used in coming up with our solution is, how do I help transform these apps towards this model? And some of that means separation of, controls from data, for example. And, how do I really persist different parts of the application, take advantage of technologies like microservices and containers or even serverless that is emerging now in the cloud world? But that whole thing is an app transformation. And once you go through and make it easy to transform these apps for the cloud model, then the question of portability or leveraging different clouds becomes one of choice for the business. For the, I mean, there might be some business application. We're working with a customer who's trying to build something that uses AWS's AI capabilities, but for data governance, wants to keep data on-premises somewhere. Those are the kinds of capabilities now all of a sudden that get unlocked by separating those controls from the cloud services and allowing them to be able to, you know, be intermingled and mixed. So that's the key, you know, philosophical position we came from. And the tenants there were really, you know, I'm an old security guy, and we have the security AAA. Everyone knows authentication and all of that great stuff. You know, in this cloud model, we think it's really around apps and how do you transform those apps to this cloud model. Automation, which is very key for your applications and your infrastructure. And really agility. And David talked about that earlier. I mean, entire businesses, every business is being disrupted today because someone out there is able to build an application faster to disrupt core business processes that were too rigid. That's what the cloud model allows people to do, is really help get beyond that. And once you truly embrace this, you know, you talk to IT leaders, they'll say, yeah, infrastructure, it's a necessary evil. We started leveraging cloud and other ways, you know, managed service providers, so we are not really focusing on that. But these apps run our business. And today, these apps actually can make or break your business. So that's
right.
Really the fundamentals of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, so who do you target? Like, who are your clients?
It's an interesting question. I think it's one of these things that we're seeing here is two kinds of customers, but really one core aspect that is a result of this cloud model adoption is that enterprise IT teams are really becoming like internal service providers. And then you have traditional service providers that might have been doing web hosting or hosting infrastructure for end customers. They have to now transform to also allow for more capabilities in this cloud model. So we're targeting, you know, global 2000 companies where, you know, the entire reason for that IT organization's existence is changing. It's about how do I help this business transformation? How do I power this digital transformation? The cloud model is key. What does it mean in terms of different businesses will choose different clouds? So you need a new control layer. And, you know, just like when you went from the mainframe era to the client-server era, the whole control and management and orchestration of that kind of infrastructure layer resulted in new software being born. We're seeing that that's what's happening in this cloud journey shift, is that you kind of need a new control plane. And you have to think about governance, you have to think about security, you have to think about, you know, every day a new compliance regulation comes around. You have to think about visibility. I mean, a lot of times people thought of, about, hey, I'm just going to start using Amazon and Azure, and it's going to be cheaper. Without the proper planning and the proper usage of resources there, they ended up being more expensive over time.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And one of the funny lines I've heard about Amazon is the most ungoverned line item on your budget is your Amazon Web Services bill, right? I think a lot of people don't realize that you really have to pay attention to those things. And if you stop paying attention and walk away or go on vacation or do something, you could come home to a big, huge bill and not really expect that, right?
Yeah, and you could have, you know, we have some customers where they had some QA scripts running that they didn't think about it. You know, great to do automation, but pulling data in and out of the cloud results in, you know, $50,000 bill at the end of the month for something you would never have thought about, you know, having to pay. So that, you know, picking the right instance. You know, there's our data shows, we have a big data analytics engine that looks across all the major clouds. We think there's about just one of the leading clouds, AWS probably has close to 50 million different instance combinations. So how does end user really pick what's the right instance? You know, how do they know what's the cost going to be, let's say 6 to 12 months from now? So that ongoing analytics, you know, bringing tools like machine learning and, you know, over time, maybe even getting into true AI capabilities are going to be required as part of this control plane.
Yep. That's right. Okay, folks, we'll come back on that. We'll talk about future proofing after the break. Folks, you are listening to DM Radio. We'll be right back.
Do you have a great idea for a radio show but have no idea where to start? Or have you been hosting a podcast for a while and want to take it to the next level? If so, you need the Gab Radio Network. To host a show on the Gab Radio Network, all you need is your voice, and we'll handle the rest. From technical engineering to full-service audio production and much more. Every show on the Gab Radio Network can be heard on our station on the TuneIn Radio app. Plus, we put all our shows on our satellite, which is accessed by 5,500 stations. And here's the best part. You can host from anywhere you want. There are many means to connect to the Gab Radio Network remotely, and our staff of highly trained engineers and producers will make you sound like you're right here in studio. So, if you want to be on the Gab Radio Network, the same network that hosts the Small Business Advocate, Radio MD, and Talkin' Pets, send an email right now to sales@gabradionetwork.com. That's sales@gabradionetwork.com.
Support for The New Possible comes from Wasabi. Wasabi is fast, affordable cloud storage for archives, videos, genomics, big data, IoT, surveillance, and much, much more. Wasabi is revolutionizing cloud storage by delivering a cheaper, faster, one-size-fits-all hot storage utility. Wasabi is fast to write, fast to read, and instantly available. Wasabi delivers the industry's lowest cost, one-fifth the price of Amazon S3, and fastest, six times the speed of Amazon S3 cloud storage service, and is 100% compatible with Amazon S3. Based in Boston, Massachusetts, Wasabi was founded by cloud storage pioneers David Friend and Jeff Flowers, the founders of Carbonite, the world's leading cloud backup company. Wasabi believes that cloud storage will become the next great global utility, making the new possible possible in businesses across the world.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks, we're all getting enlightened here. That is the soundtrack from the original Repo Man, by the way. That song is called Real 10 by the Plugs. That's Plugs with a Z. I was always fascinated by that movie, and it's so real. It's really real. It's realistic. Anyway, back here on DM Radio, talking all about the cloud, and it is real, man. It's realistic. It's changing things, and Dave Linthicum, I'd like to bring you back from Deloitte. You know, Manoj was making a really good point there at that last break about how you really have to watch for what's happening. And as they say in the Valley these days, you have to skate to where the puck's going to be, or as our producer just said, you got to take a hit to make a play. All these hockey metaphors now that the San Jose Sharks have done pretty well for a couple of years. But you do have to future-proof your environment. You got to watch out for those long-term contracts now, because you never know which bit of functionality is going to be upended by some new innovation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you got to remember that technology reinvents itself every 5 years. And I think one of the things that we need to do as technologists, even besides going after the shiny objects, is understand what are the trends that are moving forward that we need to take advantage of, and which ones, you know, can we leave alone for now, and also which ones are going to be viable, you know, for the long-term interest of the company. And I think that's where we, you know, have a tendency to fall down. We have a practice in the business that I call managing by magazines. In other words, we get excited about technology. You know, right now it's cognitive computing, it's IoT, it's blockchain, you know, lots of things that may or may not have value within our enterprise IT infrastructure. And the thing is, there has to be an overall strategic plan in terms of how we're going to utilize that technology as part of a framework. The framework needs to be consistent and durable over many years, while the technology is always going to be constantly changing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this kind of changes how you plan for things, too. I mean, one of the nice benefits of working with a cloud provider is that they will do a lot of that heavy lifting for you. And I guess Chris Cardle will bring you back in as a nice segue there from Aproio, because that's what you guys do, right? You handle the maintenance issues, you handle the upgrades, the clients just come to you and they flip the switch and their stuff comes on. If they have a problem, they come to you. But you don't have to worry about upgrading all your servers and all that overhead, which, let's face it, was really significant, not just in terms of money, but in terms of time, in terms of headaches, in terms of personnel. That's a very different world now, right?
It absolutely is. You just made the comment about all the upgrades and all the updates. You know, we call that our white glove garbage collector. We want to take on all that responsibility for folks running SAP, and it really is. I'm an old-school basis guy. In the SAP world, basis is the garbage man. We literally every day would get calls about user IDs and passwords, about dumps, about this, about that. We take on that entire responsibility. We put it in our cloud, and then we have automated tools with our bots and other solution sets that allow us to let that customer run their business. Don't run it as an IT shop. Don't worry about IT. And just let us go forward and manage and support it. And it's so clean and so easy. And it's amazing from a staff perspective how these clients now can take their staff and allow them to be really, truly a part of their business rather than just sitting there having to deal with SQL patterns and this, that, and the other on a technology side. They're now part of a business growth cycle within the organization, and it's helping them get better people, keep and retain better people, and really move their business in a new direction.
Well, you know, you just reminded me of something, yet another little aha moment listening to one of our guests. And Manoj, I'll bring you in to comment on this, and then maybe David Linthicum and Chris as well. For so long now, we've talked about the IT business divide. And it's you know, anyone who's experienced this knows exactly what I'm talking about. The business wants something done, IT pushes back. Well, sometimes IT is pushing back for good reason, because maybe they realize they don't have the bandwidth to handle another application. They may know better about this particular technology or some bug or some issue that it may have, et cetera. But a lot of times, let's face it, a lot of times IT would just say no because, you know, they didn't really want to have to worry about it. They didn't want to have to deal with it. And maybe they didn't even know what the heck was going on. Well, that kind of goes away when you start dealing with these cloud solution providers, because now the IT department, so to speak, is actually the cloud provider, and it's a service provider. And if you're, you know, if you're a service provider, you, by and large, you're going to take care of your clients, or you're going to go out of business. So I think that the cloud, in many ways, has very seriously disrupted the traditional IT business chasm. But Manoj, what do you think?
Yeah, I think absolutely right, Eric, there. You know, we see a lot of, you know, CIOs and IT leaders saying, you know, we are now responsible for business growth. It's a very different conversation than thinking, you know, we're going to keep the lights on. So I think essentially this has been one of the biggest reasons, and I think about, you know, is the cloud here to stay and is it taking over on-prem? It's not as much about, it's that model shift is really, you've seen the tipping point happen. And from an IT transformation to become the service provider and think about how better to serve the business, you need the right, whether it's the right control plane and tooling, and you need the right training and skills in the staff, that adoption, those are the key things that a lot of IT leaders are now focused on. How do I do that? How do I make sure I have the right tooling? And how do I make sure I have the right skilled people? Or how do I reskill the existing folks to be able to make sure they're able to focus on something different than keeping the lights on?
Yeah, that's right. And David Linthicum, I'm going to bring you back here. You still do need technically savvy people, and those people are, of course, going to be navigating through the different cloud providers and paying attention to what they're doing, right? Because one of the downsides, I suppose, is that now the cloud is kind of like a black box, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the, I think, misconceptions out there is that now that we have cloud, we can only hire dumb people and everything will be fine. And it just doesn't work like that. In fact, you need to get a level of understanding. People understand storage and compute systems, things like that. Who understand platforms and probably, you know, run data centers before are typically going to be the perfect people to run cloud. Even though it's not in your system, you can't go hug your server. It's, you know, thousands of miles away. Still the ability to understand what's going on, what you're buying, how you're consuming it, what they're charging you for it. And dealing with those sorts of things is a skill that we didn't think we need, but we absolutely do need. So the fact of the matter is that IT needs to become even more savvy, you know, as they move into the cloud, because now we have different players involved. So instead of us owning the technology and doing what we need to do with the technology because we have complete control over it, we have to go through another provider, typically through electronic mechanisms such as APIs and consoles and things like that, and be able to do this in a multi-cloud way and be able to do this with multiple platforms under the multi-cloud and be able to do this with multiple databases and, you know, 2,000 workloads that exist on the different cloud providers we have. It's very complex, and it ultimately it's changing the face of IT, but it's not dumbing down IT. It's actually making IT much more of a requirement and making them successful in the cloud.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned APIs, too, because we should talk about that in our last couple of minutes here. Application Program Interface, it's basically the intersection or the portal through which you access these new services. And APIs are ruling the roost these days. I mean, you think about in the data center world, there is this whole field called application integration or enterprise application integration. You know, SOA came along, the service-oriented architecture, and kind of disrupted that a little bit. We tried to abstract out a layer of management, and it was all SOAP versus REST, right? The simple object access protocol versus representational state transfer. I want to start a band and call it representational state transfer, by the way. But let me just throw this over to Chris real quick. APIs are the future, man, and API developers, I think, are really going to be the folks who keep the economy humming. What do you think?
So I agree, but I would have called them Bud after Harry Dean Stanton and Repo Man. That's just me instead of API. But that being said, APIs are everywhere. I literally have our team either developing or using an out-of-the-box API for every connection to a third-party solution that's out there. If we're going from our data center and our cloud up to Amazon, or if we're going to Azure, or if we're going to Ariba or Hybris or Concur, everything we do, we can connect with an API. So the great thing about that is it gives us some the flexibility to be able to go to literally any legacy or any third-party solution that's out there, and it's just going to keep growing more and more and more. And that's the great thing about it, is it's going to give us and organizations more flexibility to have those, to build upon them, but yet to keep them up, because you got to keep them up. You got to make sure that everything's going to be managed properly and secured in the manner that your organization and the security teams want it to be. So it really gives, it's a true benefit that's out there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Manoj, 30 seconds on APIs, the importance of APIs.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this whole transformation, APIs are really the membrane that is making that, making sure that they're connected, that, you know, helping create those new applications that are powering you know, the businesses now, and really allowing people to take advantages of cloud. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, one cloud is perfect in every service. So now with APIs, I could use an AI service somewhere, but maybe use a storage somewhere else. So very important.
Yeah, no, that's a big deal. And then finally, give 30 seconds back to David Linthicum on the importance of APIs. And, of course, you're the cloud expert, so APIs are driving the information economy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, APIs are pretty much everything when it comes to cloud, and it's really been morphing this way for years and years and years, not just the advent of cloud. We push things behind these very flexible interfaces that we're able to tie on to any number of different things. So the idea is that we create these thousands of different APIs that do these very powerful and granular things, whether it's a cloud provider, a database, you know, process system, things like that. And
that's beautiful. That's beautiful. All right, folks, you've been listening to DM Radio. Bye-bye.